So I'm very much a data person. So I'm looking at different data points. I got an Oura Ring on, I got a Fitbit on, I got some other things. There's a new technology. Instead of wearables, you heard it here first, called narrables. It's gonna be a light bulb, other things that are gonna track data.
On today's episode of Doctors in Business, our guest is Dr. John Wyatt. Dr. Wyatt is the Chief Medical Officer of WebMD, where he leads execution of the company's strategy, vision, and content. Before WebMD, he's also worked in government for the CMS and FDA, and for the Discovery Channel as a Chief Medical Expert. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Wyatt.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
So for those that don't know, could you explain a little more about the role of a chief medical officer, and especially at WebMD?
Sure. And, you know, the chief medical officer role is different at a lot of institutions. In hospital settings, it tends to be very clinical and very focused on perhaps some quality issues and other aspects of delivering care. In WebMD, it's really this role of strategy in terms of how do you also create partnerships, because health is more than just a platform. And I came to WebMD to really help iterate the platform. How do we connect content to care? Thinking about bigger issues. So there's a chief medical expert at a lot of places like WebMD, and that person oversees the content in a day-to-day. I wasn't as interested in that because I wanted to think about big picture. And that's often what chief medical officers do, and that's the case at WebMD.
Gotcha. And you've also mentioned that while doing your role as a CMO, you're seeing patients once a week. So what's your week look like?
Yeah, and I should say, I've always seen patients in every job I've had, and that's been a conscious decision and one that I've really had to insist upon when I took the job. So we were joking earlier, it's really a scheduling issue. So I am very focused on multitasking. So I really have made one day of the week in recent years my day, and that tends to be Fridays. And there's some exceptions to that, but that's helpful because then everyone knows that. But I'll tell you, even when I'm in clinic, I'm back and forth on my emails trying to do what I joke is my day job as well. And then the rest of the week really is collaborating with the other executives of the company, representing the brand, continue to think, how do we improve the delivery of information, especially at a time when there's a lot of misinformation, and really networking. I've always enjoyed talking to people. I think that's why I chose internal medicine as opposed to some other professions. And then the role of chief medical officer is not a research role. It's really interacting with your colleagues, patients, and other executives.
And how is seeing patients continuously throughout your career helped you kind of maintain or develop that strategy of your company? Yeah.
You know, what I love about it, David, and I joke with my wife sometimes, it's incredibly grounding. Because in clinic, most people do not know my day job. And I could have been, and this is real life, in Houston Methodist and meeting with the chief innovation officer and the executive vice president and being given a tour of this amazing facility. And the next day I'm in clinic and nobody cares. They want to know where's their metformin, what their lipid panel is. And it reminds you in health what people are thinking about and what's on patients' minds. And I often get asked to consult on AI projects and other aspects. And what I've been surprised by is that developers often don't understand workflow. Like, this is not how it works in the clinical setting. Like, no one's going to adopt this technology, even if it works. Because if you have a lab that someone does at home that is sent as a PDF to the doctor, that's not the workflow. It has to appear, you know, in the lab section. We don't search medical records to find something. So it's been incredibly rewarding. It's challenging, as I said, in terms of a schedule, but it reminds you what you're doing. Even when I worked in government, I was able to still do clinical time, and it reminds you what's the impact And if I couldn't understand regulations as a physician, how would I expect others to understand it? So that's what's really cool about it in some ways. It's very grounding, and it reminds you what it's like to actually be, you know, on the ground in terms of delivering care or receiving care.
Yeah, I think it helps you better understand the customer experience of healthcare. But I don't really believe you when you say they don't recognize you because you're the face of what
every now and then, every now and then they do. But for the most part, even if they bring it up, I don't mention it. I just move on.
Gotcha.
But they're really focused on why they're there that day, and that's what's important.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, you got your MD and did your residency and fellowship and started working for the CMS. Mm-hmm. So what led you towards that instead of just traditionally practicing medicine?
Yeah. As you know, I went to the University of Pennsylvania for college, and the Leonard Davis Institute was there, which at that time, very few universities focused on health economics. And I was really fascinated about understanding payment mechanisms, about understanding regulation. And at first I thought I wanted to be a surgeon. And, you know, I started in medical school, but I was still interested in these health policy issues. And I thought, well, maybe I'll do an MD JD, or no one did an MD MBA back then. So I thought, I'll do an MD MPH, a Master's of Public Health, and really became interested in these broader policy issues. And then when I started thinking about a residency and going through medical school, I liked surgery, but I was like, I don't want to be, you know, in the OR 10 hours a day. I want to talk about these other issues, which I really started to think about as an undergraduate at Penn. So that's what really shaped how I wanted to work on health policy issues. I still wanted to see patients, and I'll tell you, that was a challenge, because medicine is very hierarchical. And here I was at Stanford, I did a master's of public health, I did a, you know, a full residency, I did a fellowship, and I'd say to folks, you know, I want to be involved in these quality issues, or I want to be involved in these policy issues. And all the doctor types would be like, John, work in clinic for 5 years, serve on some committees, this very, you know, pay your dues type of approach. And there were not a lot of MPHs and MDs back then. There are now, luckily. So I really forged my own path. And I knew some folks in government, and I came to Washington because I wanted to work on health policy, and I had a great opportunity at CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where there were not a lot of physicians at the time, and really had a direct role in impacting what services were covered and how we determined whether or not something was medically necessary and reasonable.
Yeah, and I think in medicine, there's very much of a set path for you to follow, and it's hard to break out of that, which is kind of the whole point of this podcast, to get creative physicians on and talk about how their medical perspective has helped their career in business or anything else.
Yeah.
And so you're usually in my shoes interviewing physicians and healthcare professionals, and you obviously have a great network of people you could talk to. So what's your or WebMD's decision-making process in deciding what content to pursue or who you want to interview?
You know, our philosophy has been that better information leads to better health. And it really is true. Knowledge is power, but it has to be the right information. And sometimes where I struggle in terms of digital health, there's a lot of cool technologies out there. And I love talking about these technologies. But I'm also very practical, David, in terms of what's available for patients now. What's available for my physician colleagues now? Because I don't want them to get too excited about a technology that doesn't actually exist. And I don't want to be a consumer review. That's not our platform in terms of we're rating different products. But I want to find people who are credible. I want to talk to people who are passionate about a subject matter and that are really focused on making a difference. I interviewed the other day Arthur Brooks, who wrote a book with Oprah. So, you know, you can't go too wrong writing a book with Oprah. But it was about happiness. But it was about the data behind living a happy life. And he really was trying to bring science into it. And, you know, I can be a bit of a skeptic at times, so I was really pushing him on. The fact how we're using MRI scanning, we're using PET scanning, we're trying to look at biomarkers. Those are the things that are fascinating. And a lot of these technologies are iterative. They're going to get better. And what I want to do is actually get patients engaged, and I want to get clinicians engaged. Because all too often, physicians have, you know, this clinical inertia. I'm used to doing things the way I'm used to doing them, and I don't want to change, and I'm not going to change. And then I don't get involved. And we often have a wait-and-see approach. And I think with technologies nowadays and the changing ecosystem, it's important to have clinicians involved. And I'd like to see more of that. So that's what I try to promote as well.
Yeah, and I think this very much connects back to you mentioning that seeing patients is grounding and humbling and lets you understand their perspective very well. You mentioned emerging technologies and want to jump into kind of the AI conversation.
Sure.
So do you consider these ChatGPTs and these large language models to be perhaps not now, but later once it gets better in handling more accurate information to be WebMD's competitor?
No, I don't think that. What the term that I've been hearing lately, often from the American College of Physicians, the American Medical Association, that I like very much, is instead of artificial intelligence, augmented intelligence. It's going to help me make decisions better. And where I see this tension going on right now is a lot of people on the physician side are like, oh, it's going to help me schedule. It's going to, you know, help me, you know, do patient reminders and other things or answer questions. The real power of AI is the power of the deliberative decision making. How do I take all this unstructured data, structure it, and make better decisions? So at WebMD, we use AI right now in terms of our symptom checker to help guide. But we're very careful at WebMD to say, we're not giving you medical advice. We're trying to empower you with some information to talk to your physician about conditions. And we're very interested in these platforms because they're only going to get better. But, you know, I can say every piece of our content is reviewed by a board certified physician, reviewed by a human and written by a human. How things may change over the next few years, we'll have to see. But this is the issue in terms of the tension between consumers want to do everything on their own. And there's some generational aspect to that. Why do I have to go see a doctor if I can figure this out all out online? But we know there's challenges at times with the information, this concept of hallucination, where it's giving you the wrong data. The other element I would say to that, David, is physicians make mistakes. There are errors that occur that are preventable every year in the healthcare system. Physicians have bias as well. We know that people of color are treated differently across disease specialty. So if we can use technologies to be explicit about those biases and reduce those biases, those are a good thing. And we should all embrace it and make it better. So I'm excited about these technologies and how we will use them. But, you know, WebMD has been around for 27 years. There's been a lot of other companies that have come and gone. And we've persisted for many reasons because the quality of our product, the work that we put into it, and the fact that we're really trying to empower people, you know, with information. And I don't think AI is going to replace doctors. But it's really this augmented intelligence.
Yeah, and I think if I want to look up my health or any information related to that, I probably won't go to ChatGPT because I want someone vetted. I want someone with experience, and I don't want any chance of misinformation.
Right, because health is wealth. You know, at the end of the day, all we have is our health. And all too often, we wait until much later in life, till after we have children, till after we've been successful in business, to then focus on our health. And often that's too late, that we need to move it earlier. So these technologies do have a role, and they're going to continue to get better. But as it stands right now, there are some concerns about the quality of the information that they deliver.
And one of your job is to execute the strategy of WebMD. And So how is WebMD looking to grow in the near future? And what are some of the recent initiatives that you took on at the company?
Yeah, and we've been growing over, you know, the last, you know, decade. And really what's interesting is, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, the way that people searched was they'd search information online. I still remember when people would print it up and then they'd go to their doctor and say, you know, oh, I was on WebMD or wherever. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. Patients either come in often and tell me what they think they have, or more often what we see, if you search joint pain or you search arthritis, you want to do something right then. You want to get an x-ray today. You want to do an x-ray tomorrow. You have a suspicious mole. You don't want to wait 4 months to be able to go see a dermatologist. So what we've been doing is we're able to help arrange a telemedicine appointment for you so you can go right then. If you search signs and symptoms of STDs on WebMD, depending upon the state that you live in, because medicine is regulated by the states, we can send you information about how you can go get a lab test to check for STDs. And I'll tell you, at first, I was like, oh, I don't know if that's a good idea. You know, the typical patrician, matrician role of physicians, like, you need to come in, I need to talk to you about safe sex. But what we know is a lot of people didn't come in. So everything's not perfect in terms of the strategy. But if I'm able to help do that in terms of making people have STD testing more available, that's a good thing. I was very interested in creating a book business when I came to WebMD. And people were like, you're an online platform, you're digital, why are you creating a print business? Because I know a lot of people still like to read books and read print. So that was an initiative which is still being evaluated in terms of we came out with 3 books, Take Control of Your Diabetes Risk, Take Control of Your Cancer Risk, Take Control of Your Heart Disease Risk, which is really the WebMD model, empowering you with information. So we continue to iterate to connect content that we have to care. We have a business called WebMD Ignite, which is really about hospital and health systems. How do they recruit more patients? How do they engage more with patients? We have a health coaching business called WebMD Health Services that many people aren't familiar with. We own Medscape, which is the biggest provider of continuing medical education for healthcare providers globally around the world. So we're continuing to iterate and to grow, and it's really exciting to be involved in health at this point.
I actually didn't know that you were able to schedule a telemedicine appointment through WebMD.
Depending upon what you search, sure.
So you're really taking that step further from just making information available, but rather allowing these patients to take the initiative and go beyond just
connecting
learning about it.
Content, right? It's connecting the content to care.
And I want to talk about this briefly just because this is what we're discussing in class, in my healthcare management class. But
sure.
We talked about direct-to-consumer advertising, and that's also making information available to the patients directly and making them bring it up at their doctor's visits. So what are your thoughts on that? Because I think there's some controversy on that because the U.S. and New Zealand is the only countries that allow direct-to-consumer.
You're talking about pharmaceutical. You're talking about drug advertising, you know, pharmaceutical advertising. So I think it's important that advertising is always labeled as such and being transparent. And that hasn't always been the case by some players. So our content is clearly labeled sponsored when it's provided by drug companies. You know, as a clinician, I'm all about having important conversations with patients. So patients will come into the office and say, I think I should be on X because they saw the drug advertised on television. And I'll point out that they may or may not fit the indication for it. You know, and why do they feel they need to be on it? And I should say, I was at the Food and Drug Administration, so, you know, full disclosure on that in terms of the perspective there. And we have an Office of Prescription Drug Promotion, which is exactly that, about advertising of prescription drug. Sometimes there are some bad apples in terms of they go beyond their labeling in terms of what they claim, but they are the exception, not the norm. Nowadays, I think it's all about empowering patients with information, knowing where it's from, right? So having that transparency. So if you know it's from a drug company, you should consider that in terms of your decision making. But I'm not like some physicians who are like, oh, I think it should all be banned. I look at it as a way to promote conversation, to follow the regulations around it, and, you know, enforce them when there are some bad apples.
Gotcha.
I mean, right now, when you think about it, everyone knows about the GLP-1, right, in terms of obesity. And that's because it's in the news, but it's also because of advertising. They've heard about it. But that's a great discussion to have with patients. Why do they think they need to be on it? What have they tried with lifestyle? What are the risks versus benefits? The challenge, David, is when patients come in and ask that, that requires, you know, a bit of time to have that conversation. And all too often, physicians don't have enough time to talk about it. What are they saying in class? Good, bad, or indifferent?
They're just telling us to take a stance and argue. So I think I think there's pros and cons. But you mentioned GLP-1. And I think the answer to your question was, if they don't have time at the physician's office, they go online and do their own research, which is where WebMD comes in. And
But this is where transparency matters, because where you go and search it is very important. So people don't usually, in terms of behavior, scroll more than like 3, you know, prompts down. Often advertising a sponsor site is at the top because they might have paid to be there in terms of the ranking. And that's what's important to talk to patients. And I've had to do that. I'm like, this is a drug sponsor site. And it's labeled as such, but people may not always notice that. But then you also want to confirm that information elsewhere. You want to go to other, you know, sites, physician organizations. You know, pharmacists are a great source of information as well. And I never really understood the role of pharmacists as well as I should have until I went to FDA, because I primarily have lived in urban areas. And if anyone asks a question at the pharmacist, people are annoyed because, you know, there's 5 people behind you and you want them to move on. But in smaller communities, pharmacists are an important source of information for patients, and often will be able to take the time. It's a little harder now to have those conversations. And this also brings up the broader topic of misinformation, where people are getting their information online and how they're evaluating it. And all too often I've had patients and I say, well, how do you decide if this information is right? Because, you know, I'm interested in all this stuff. And they'll say, you know, 8 times out of 10, they'll say, I can tell. And I'll say, like, how can you tell? And it's just like, well, I can tell. And I was like, I'm not sure. So that's where we also have to give them guidance as well.
Yeah, and I think WebMD comes in there clearly. I want to ask you about what you decide to put on when there's, so for example, over these Ozempics and there's a lot of like news about like side effects or risks. Mm-hmm. And how do you decide what information to put on WebMD and to warn patients and to educate them?
And I want to be clear, we have guardrails. So our editorial group is truly separate from our advertising group. So there is no, you know, overlap in terms of those roles. You know, we have a journalistic arm, and there you really have to have those guardrails. When content is sponsored, it's clearly labeled as sponsored, and people can weigh that. You know, part of it is, you know, we have a good understanding of what people are searching. So we want to be able to provide them good content based on search. We are able to know what are the top trending issues in general on Google that people are looking for. And we try to respond to that as well. You know, obviously we're talking about, you know, weight loss and GLP-1 because that's what people want to read about and learn about. But we're also talking about balance. everything is about risks and benefits. You know, that's what I discussed at FDA. So on, you know, some of these new medications, in an older population, we also have to talk about the possibility of sarcopenia. So you lose muscle mass as well as fat mass. They don't discriminate about the type of loss that they're having. And there may be some differences in the newer drugs, but that's something that we have to be aware of. What I've learned at FDA, you know, post-market surveillance is very important. And we often find signals in a much larger population than we did in a smaller one. So we just have to be vigilant about that. And it has to be balanced as well. And that's why we have an expert review it. And if you look on WebMD, every piece of content says who it was reviewed by. You can click on to see that person's credentials, and it is dated. And a lot of sites don't do that. And that has an important point as well, because we're being transparent.
I think it's really good to know that the editorial arm is separate from the advertising arm, because
it has to be.
Yeah. There's no misaligned incentives there now. I want to briefly talk about what WebMD was like during the pandemic as well, because I think there was a lot of uncertainty and misinformation then. What was it like being in charge of that company during the pandemic?
There are a lot of people in charge, and it really was a team effort. But it's interesting because in that way, I really became a public face of WebMD, which was not the job that I came to do. But, you know, it really was a time where information was so critical. And our CEO really said, we're going to be the leader in providing the best information. And I'll tell you, that was a period of time where our traffic was the highest ever in terms of people searching, because everyone was at home. So we started this coronavirus context video series where I literally interviewed over 400 people. I talked to the CEO about what we were doing literally every day, multiple times a day, to see how can we make sure we have the best information for people. We also were responsive, where we saw people were searching a great deal about anxiety medications. That's what they were looking up. Not necessarily anxiety about, but putting anxiety medications. And what we also had to figure out, David, is because the way that search works, even if there are, you write, so there's a post that's inaccurate, and there were a lot of posts that were inaccurate. If you start to respond to that, you're actually amplifying it in the search. So sometimes people would say, why didn't you respond to this? Or why didn't you respond to that? You know, where there's misinformation. Sometimes we didn't, because we didn't want to promote it. And what we focused on was how do we provide the best information that's available at that time, because some things changed, and do it in a way where we're talking to experts. And you know, we saw different things, you know, at times. When I first interviewed Dr. Fauci, you know, probably was our biggest, you know, interview in terms of the number of views. And the third or fourth time, you know, people were fading out a little. And we had to respond to that as well. So it was a very challenging time. It's one which I'll never forget in terms of the opportunity to play an important role. And it really also was the role of educating, you know, our teams internally as well, and our employees, and really trying to find that balance of trying to provide hope, right? Because if you remember, there were a lot of days where it really was scary. And how do you provide the best information at the time while addressing misinformation, while not promoting that? And that was, you know, challenging to do. But we learned a lot during that time. And I think our numbers, given how well we did in terms of search, you know, showed that we were a credible source for people.
It's awesome. I think it's a really fresh perspective to know that when I see a tweet that's just ridiculous, and you just want to explain why this is wrong, et cetera, but you want to take control of the algorithm kind of. And
I know it's hard not to do that. And there's a lot of discussion about changing how the algorithm works. So if you write some crazy thing from a health perspective and 100 people are writing, you're nuts, this is completely wrong, this is how it works, that's actually going to be amplified under some algorithms where more people will see it. And that's the challenge to address this. And there's lots of issues on social in terms of what people literally are fed in terms of their feed. And you start to see only people that have the same mindset of you. So there's lots of discussions about that. And folks at YouTube, Garth Graham, who's a physician, runs their health side, Karen DeSalvo, who's a physician, over at Google. We've had lots of discussions about how do we address the issue of misinformation. But we also have to try to empower people to say, well, how can you tell what's right and what's wrong? And I just the other day, someone says to me, oh, you know, I read an article about eggs being created, you know, in another area of the world that were not from chickens. You know, can they cause cancer? And I did say, like, where did you see this? And they showed me the site. And I'm like, that's not a credible, that's not a credible site. It sounded credible, partly, you know, like a .com. And I'm like, does that sound normal to you? I was like, you need to check other sites. You need to check other things. And then I told my 9-year-old, I said, do you think, you know, eggs can be manufactured, you know, in a lab outside of, you know, chicken? And he's like, no. And I thought, see, he has a good perspective. But it's also, and maybe it will be like that, you know, in a few years. But you have to be a little bit of a detective. You have to be cynical. And David, just because you're at Penn and there's Wharton, what I've been saying to people and trying to make the comparison to is no one just believes anyone online that gives financial advice, right? What would you do? You'd look to make sure what the site was. You'd try to corroborate it. Does it exist anywhere else? You'd think, is this person credible? You'd really would do a little bit of your own homework, or you should, as most do, before they'd invest their money, because that's really important. But when it comes to their health, which is the most important commodity they have, it's kind of like, well, you know, an influence setter, so I'm going to try this diet, or I'm going to, you know, do what they did. And we often don't have that level of additional review when it comes to our own health that we do in terms of our financial health. So that's what's I find remarkable in terms of searching information online. I don't know if you agree with that, but it's a comparison that I think deserves more attention.
No, 100%. And I think it's more difficult because there's an overwhelming amount of information online, and most people are busy going about their day and to take the time out to do all the research and all the thinking, what's right, who should I trust. You really need a central, reliable source. Wrapping up, what's a new problem in healthcare that's emerging that you or WebMD is currently working on to address?
You know, and I'm not sure I'd call it a problem. I think it's a trend, which is the broader discussion that we've been having, where there's really this consumerism of healthcare, what we might call the retail. Healthcare has become retail. Right, so before the pandemic, you never thought you could do a lab test at home. How many of us have done COVID tests at home? How many of us have bought a pulse oximeter? How many of us are, you know, doing a gazillion genetic tests, swabbing, you know, our throat, cheeks, and looking at our genome? There's more and more ability to do information at home and to buy it yourself. You can buy a whole bunch of things at CVS and Walmart in terms of lab tests and other tools, which we never had before. And patients' expectations have changed. Why should I have to go to the doctor's office if I can do this at home? Here we're all having wearables in terms of collecting this biometric data on a continuous basis. Yet we're not utilizing that unstructured data for personalization. And then when you take into, I can look up things on ChatGPT. You know, I have all this other information. I'm not sure we have all the guardrails for this. So, you know, the White House has put out something on AI. It's pretty vague. You know, the FDA still hasn't done a good job in terms of truly what's a medical device and what's not. They haven't updated for where we are nowadays. And we have this ability to truly have patient-centric care, what I would call patient-driven care, right? They need to be in the driver's seat. But we haven't quite worked out all the mechanics. Because, David, do I really care what your blood pressure is when you come into the office? Sure, but you come once or twice a year, maybe once every other year. But if I can do your blood pressure at home, I can do your heart rate at home on a continuous basis, that's great data. But how am I utilizing that? And we have it figured it out. You want to talk about personalization of data? That's personalization. But how is that impacting your therapeutic decision making? So as we have this consumerization, how are we democratizing it, right? Because you shouldn't just have it if you can afford these devices, you can afford these technologies at home. How are we making sure that they're accurate and we're giving good information? And how do we not get rid of the clinician? There's a reason why we went to medical school, pharmacy school, nursing school, right? You can't do it all at home. I don't assume I can do legal issues at home just by looking online. And the medical community has to evolve as well in terms of how we provide care. So a lot of big challenges, but it's really from this consumerization, this retailization of healthcare.
Yeah, totally agree. What are some of your personal goals related or unrelated to WebMD, could be totally separate, that you'd like to share with us?
Well, like a lot of people, I'm trying to lose weight. But I'm using a lot of data. So I'm very much a data person. So I'm looking at different data points. I got an Oura Ring on, I got a Fitbit on, I got some other things. There's a new technology, instead of wearables, you heard it here first, called narrables. It's gonna be a light bulb, other things that are on track data. I'm trying to learn French better, because I feel as we get older, you know, learning a language is a great skill to help keep the brain active. So I'm trying to learn a language, and we're actually going to go to Europe on spring break this year. So I'm getting my kids engaged in learning another language. Those are the two near-term things that I've been working on, because I don't think people should have too many goals, you know, all at one time. But, you know, fundamentally, you know, David, my goal has always been, how do I impact people's lives? How do I make a difference? And I also learned that some great sociology classes at Penn with this professor named Renee Fox, who's no longer with us. But it really was about, how do you make a difference in the world? And that's what I've chosen to do with the different, you know, career paths I've been on. And that's what, you know, I hope to continue to do as a goal, you know, in the next few years as well.
I think you've brought so much fresh perspective to the discussion. From, you have experience in private and government sectors, you're working in corporate, but also seeing patients at the same time. So thank you so much for the informative decision, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your leadership. I always enjoy hearing, you know, from students who are doing these great projects and podcasts and thinking about issues in a way that I didn't even think about, and I thought I was being progressive at the time. So kudos to all of you who are thinking about it now, because it truly will shape your career, and you'll be better prepared to address many of these challenges that we'll have in the future.
If you like what you're hearing, don't forget to subscribe, tell a friend, leave a review. We would love to hear from you.